It became kind of this internal conflict with the business. And finally, you know, they approached me and said, hey, we want to cut off funding for disc golf. And I kind of put my foot down and just said, hell no.
Welcome to Patent Pending, a show about the future of disc golf. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and on the show today, why a belt company decided to dive headfirst into disc golf and what it might take for other companies to do the same. Before sponsoring disc golf events was even a thought, an engineer named BJ Minson was in his garage launching a Kickstarter for a new belt that he designed. And after a wildly successful campaign with 10,000 belts sold, BJ's company Grip6 would go on to revolutionize how products are made in the USA. Based out of Salt Lake City, Grip6 now makes belts, socks, and wallets, and their products have been used anywhere from Hollywood to outer space. And all of that is amazing. But it also got me thinking, what was the through line for a belt company to go from being completely unaware of disc golf to diving in head first? It turns out that the secret behind Grip6's involvement in disc golf all started with one of Grip6's partners, Kevin Rogers. But even though Kevin, BJ, and the other two partners, David and Winslow, have known each other for years, Kevin's desire to get the other three on board with disc golf would be an uphill battle, to say the least.
So I'm a fly fisherman. I just got back Sunday from a fly fishing trip on the Green River, and our company owns an older, like a 2003, I think, fiberglass drift boat. I don't know how many readers or listeners know what a drift boat is, but it's a raft that's way more fragile.
Yeah.
But anyway, designed to go down rivers, and this thing lives at a lake, not on a river. You know, fly fishing is more fun on a river, and so it's not super expensive, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 maybe, but I sent out a text to everybody saying, hey, any issues if I take the drift boat down the green? Just full disclosure, I've never done it before. You know, I've rowed a lot on lakes and I kayak. So I've paddled, but the principles of kayaking are different than rowing. And, you know, there's a chance I'm going to put a ding in the boat. And the first response was Dave, I think. And he's like, of course it's okay, because if you damage the boat, we'll have, you know, tons of stuff to make fun of you for the next two or three years.
Yeah, of course.
So that's kind of, it's a great example of like what it's like for us. So when I came to the group with disc golf, first of all, I'll back up a little bit. My sons, I have two boys, Henry and Owen, 17 and 12, I think now. And they love Ultimate. To this day, both play competitive Ultimate. I think it was a coach or something had kind of suggested that they play disc golf. And this was probably 7 years ago during the off season. You know, I still find it fascinating. The throwing motions are so different.
It is surprising that the coach would recommend that, but it's really cool nonetheless.
Yeah. Like they, now that they're both good at both of those things, there is a solid 2 to 3 week period where during that transition, they're terrible. They can't throw the disc at all. And then they switch back to Ultimate and they can't throw the Frisbee. So they're really not that compatible, to be honest. Other than they both happen to be made out of a plastic saucer thing, there's really not a lot of...
It's understanding aerodynamics and the flight patterns of things, but the mechanics from disc
very
to
different.
Disc vary, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So at the same time, I think it was kind of like this aha moment. At the same time, there was a course that I grew up playing regular golf on. It's like this little par three situation. And it's so short. You know, as a kid, it was like $2 to play. So I loved just going over there on my bike and paying $2. And you could play the whole thing with like an 8 and a 9 and a wedge maybe.
Yeah.
There was one hole that we would always have contests where you didn't use a club at all. You just threw the ball. That's how short it was. Over time, it had lost favor. And I'm like a bit of a deep diver. And so I started looking into the course a little bit and found out that in its history, it was the first disc golf course ever to be in Utah.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, I want to say, don't quote me on this. Like back in the 70s, they originally opened it up as a disc golf course, but it didn't take. A little premature.
What's the park called?
It's called Roots now, which is why they gave it that name.
Oh, cool.
You know, it was the root of the disc golf scene in Utah. Anyway, at the time, though, it didn't take. And so they converted it to this awkwardly small, you know, traditional golf course.
Huh.
9 holes of ridiculously small pitch pitch shots. Anyway, they were converting it back to disc golf. I remember driving past it and, you know, I got my kids saying, hey, let's give it a try. So we go over there. I think similar stories to a lot of people. We don't own disc golf discs. I think we had several Ultimate discs. I think even an Aerobee might have been thrown at one point. You know, we fumble our way through it and trying to keep score, and holy crap, do we suck. I'm a very honest person to this day. I think I downloaded the U-Disc app fairly early, and some of those early rounds I scored, you know, wow, with that stuff. And we shot like 40 over or something terrible, you know. And so my U-Disc average to this day includes those terrible scores. I'm continually trying to drive it down, but I'm too proud to delete those scores. But anyway, my kids took to it. My wife was a little slow, but if she eventually came on, she's a decent player as well. We actually just played in a tournament for Utah State a couple weeks ago as a family. I started, the marketer, the businessman in me started looking around, and I played this course as a kid, and you know, as a ball golf course, and there was like two cars in the parking lot, and we'd show up on Saturdays, and the parking lot was full.
Wow.
And I start looking around, and I look at U-Disc, and there's courses popping up. You know, it wasn't as prolific as it is today, but you could spot the trend if you're paying attention.
Yeah, about what year is this that you're starting to think about this?
2015, 2014, somewhere in there. We start finding stuff on YouTube. You know, I'm looking around. I attend trade shows for a living, and so I knew Keen had dabbled into it. So there were a couple other larger companies. I actually tried to reach out to Keen to see if there was anybody there who could give me some direction on whether or not there was a useful marketing play for them. And I couldn't get a hold of anybody that would give me heads or tails on that one. But eventually I took it to the group and said, hey, I think that this sport's going somewhere. I gave them all the merits. You know, my family's playing as a group. I'm talking to like every dad, you know, I'm having conversations with my sons on the course, you know, that's, I don't know. Yeah. I don't want to get too cheesy or sappy with people, but, you know, I think the division between adults and kids is worse today than ever. But, you know, all of a sudden we had this thing where we could go out there and compete, you know, side by side and have a good time and talk. And, you know, it was kind of priceless. So our little disc golf tree started. We started bringing other people in. Anyway, we brought Disc Grip 6 on. And
so what was the reaction like from the partners? Was it immediate stoke, or was it hard resistance?
It was not hard resistance. No, that's not how it was. Similar to the drift boat, you know, like, sure, of course we can get into disc golf.
We can make fun of you for something.
Exactly. Yeah. I took it upon myself, you know, I think this is going to work. And I'm like, we need an acid test. Two things that we did, DGPT back then, that was the funnest part of the whole deal, is where we had been doing these advertising plays before where we couldn't even get a conversation. We couldn't even get in front of the people that we needed to talk to in order to set up the deal. And now we've got, you know, the commissioner of the DGPT on speed dial, you know. Wow. We've got professionals that we can just talk to face to face if we want to. That was a revelation for us. If anything, it just made it, in my opinion, far more attractive than any of this type of marketing play that we had done in the past. I was pretty excited at the potential just from the get-go. We created this commercial. My creative team created this commercial, and I remember, probably still find it somewhere. I'm sure that's how the internet works. It's out there somewhere. The very first commercial we made for DGPT, we decided to use the tagline, the official belt of disc golf, which wasn't very hard to do because there wasn't any other belts in disc golf. We still joke about it to this day that, you know, all you have to do is just say that you are, and you are. So there was that element. And then we decided to go to the Beaver State Fling.
This is like 2018, right? I think that's technically on record as like when you became the official belt of disc golf.
Maybe. I want to say 2017, but okay. If you've done your homework, I'm going to let you.
Not only have I done my homework, but I've seen the video you just mentioned as well. So I'll just tell people it's out there, and if they want to find it, they can.
I'll dive into it. We might have made it in 2017 and put it out spring of 20. I don't remember. Yeah. Anyway, so we go to Beaver State Fling. By the way, you know, I go there again, family, like my kids are working the booth with me. First of all, I don't think anybody expected that we would be there because we weren't disc golf specific brand. I think we were shocked at how big of a deal that was. People really had a tendency to gravitate toward us because we were non-disc golf.
Because at that point, every other booth is retailers, disc golf specific brands.
Yes.
Okay.
And by the way, the tournament director there, I forget his name, but he was phenomenal. I mean, like the crowd, the whole community of disc golf was it was the icing on the cake that I needed to see. But they had the tents arranged in a half circle. And at one point during the 3-day tournament, they decided to put a basket in the middle of said half circle. And it didn't take long because I think it was just there for people to test the discs that they might want to buy from each of the vendors. But after a while, like when it was slow, the vendors themselves started trying to put up these 40 footers, you know, and we watched, we were like kind of shy because, you know, these guys were thinking that we're not very good. And a couple of my sons, well, I only have two, but my sons are actually pretty good.
Nice.
And so one of them is like, you know, a little more brazen than me, decides to grab a couple discs and give it a go. And like, I think out of four discs, sinks three out of the four.
Wow.
And, you know, all these other tents are like, who is that kid, you know, coming over? And then I grab a couple and I think I made two out of four. And, you know, my wife didn't play at the time, but Henry, my oldest, I think, put in a few as well. And it was like all of a sudden we were accepted on some level that I've never seen. Like, hey, these guys play actually, you know, and they were giving my kids discs. Pros were coming over and signing autographs on my kids' discs. And it was like the highlight of their summer.
Wow.
And I came home and did the math. I asked the tournament director what the attendance was. You know, I wanted to figure out how, because this was my acid test, how did we do?
Yeah.
And it turned out we sold a belt to like, it wasn't quite, it was probably a percentage point or two off, but we sold a belt to every other person who came to the event.
Wow.
Which blew my mind.
That is not a normal conversion rate at all.
No.
Yeah.
No. And it has, I think we might have experienced it once or twice after that. But still, it's been crazy higher than any other thing we've ever done. That I came home to the group and said, you know, this is real. We're in it. Hmm. And we've kind of been foot on the gas ever since. So.
Yeah. Wow. Incredible. That's 2018-ish, maybe a little later, maybe a little earlier. And then really, it seems Grip Six has had a pretty steady involvement in disc golf ever since. Would you say that's true? Or were there waves where it was higher involvement or less involvement? Has it just been immediate, like welcoming through the community? What's the experience been since saying, all right, foot on the gas, let's go?
I would say we've always been involved. The ebb and flow, yes. But so where the face-to-face, which was largely me, being the primary source of the disc golf connection with Grip Six to the community of disc golf, you know, and that my boys and my wife liked to, we probably attend two or three of these events a year. I was seeing something in a face-to-face arena that was different than what our marketers were seeing on the digital side. So the bottom line was we didn't have the proper metrics to tell us exactly how good it was. We knew that it was good. We knew that we were doing certain tests that every business has to do this. In marketing, you're always finding some kind of a method of trackability. And especially now with the digital side, it's so traceable that anything less than that is kind of like, I don't want to do that. And the face-to-face has that same thing too. Conversions are happening right in front of you, but there's a void that happens between those two things that is very difficult to track. And so we had this decision to make as a company with the exit interview on our sales platform, like how did you hear about us kind of a thing. And we had solid data saying that if you ask too many questions in that realm, that people will not answer it. And in other words, if there are eight choices, you'll just get zeros because there's too many and they won't take the time to read it. So I was pushing pretty hard for confirmation. I wanted it to be on that exit interview so I could know for sure if disc golf was driving traffic to our site.
Yeah.
The same way that it was in person, right?
Absolutely.
But there was a lot of resistance toward doing that, not because of anti-disc golf, but because it was one more spot on
too many
that
questions.
Thing. And, yeah. Exactly. We instead decided to go down a different path. We reached out to a couple, two, three, four pros, started making signature models.
This is Big Germ, Nate Sexton, those first few. Yeah.
Even Paul Macbeth at one point, you know, we had a bunch. We were about to add a fourth when the thing kind of morphed into a different direction for this reason. The point there was, okay, if we sold a lot of those things, that would be our proof in the pudding. We needed to see if that was happening. But I had a hunch.
Yeah.
That wasn't going to work. And I'll tell you why. We had done a couple generic, you know, we have the ability to customize our stuff. And so even as early as that same tournament at Beaver State Fling, I had made these, you know, disc golf specific buckles that had like you know, little guys throwing on them or a basket in the lower left corner. Yeah. And our standard buckles were outselling those things like 6-1. So a signature model may have a little bit more clout, but I already knew that it wasn't going to tell us with the same authority what I needed to know.
Yeah.
And it didn't. As a matter of fact, all it did was make the marketing team look at it and go, this isn't working on a level that we feel like we can continue pumping money into disc golf. It became kind of this internal conflict with the business. And finally, you know, they approached me and said, hey, we want to cut off funding for disc golf. And I kind of put my foot down and just said, hell no.
Wow.
No, we're not doing that until we know for sure. So I asked them, I said, hey, 2 weeks, let's just put disc golf on the exit interview for 2 weeks. They agreed to do it for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, I didn't even ask them. I kind of just let them do their job. Our kind of marketing guru, his name's Neil, comes into my office and he's like, we have to keep disc golf.
Wow.
I'm like, really? It's good? He's like, not only is it good, it's the number one niche thing we do, like by a landslide. So we have like, you know, here's Facebook and Google and blah, 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 and disc golf was right there. And then there's like 30 other things that, that were on the exit interview that, you know, disc golf dwarfed those things.
So, Grip 6 decided to go all in, and as many of us now know, would go on to become one of the sport's biggest advocates. In 2020, for example, Grip 6 was the presenting sponsor for the Disc Golf Pro Tour Championship, which benchmarked a milestone in the history of disc golf. Equal payouts for the MPO and FPO divisions, something Kevin mentioned they were extremely proud of. But as the sport continues to grow, what will it take for companies similar to Grip 6 to turn their attention towards disc golf? Answers to that question and more after the break. Have you ever wondered how Jomez Pro is able to employ 20 full-time crew members, produce tournament coverage, create off-season series like The Putting Game, and develop podcasts like this one? Well, it's because of one amazing group of diehard disc golf fans, the Jomez Pro Patreon community. The financial support Jomez Pro receives from Patreon is essential to their mission of pushing disc golf to new places. It's also a great place to influence what happens behind the scenes. They often post videos before the public to get everyone's feedback, and it's just a great place to discuss topics like your favorite touring pros and cool merch ideas. So if that sounds like something you'd like to be a part of, consider joining. They have three tiers to fit your budget, and on top of all of that, they post exclusive content that doesn't get published on the YouTube channel, monthly giveaways like signed discs and practice baskets, big discounts to their shop, and you can even get your name listed on the coverage by signing up for the Founders Club. You can visit jomezpro.com/Patreon and sign up today to get instant access to all of the Patreon benefits. Honestly, aside from just watching, or listening in this case, signing up for the Jomez Pro Patreon is easily the most impactful way to support Jomez Pro and their mission. So sign up today at jomezpro.com/Patreon, and if you're already one of the 3,000 plus members, thank you. Welcome back to the show. As you now know, Grip 6 would have abandoned disc golf a long time ago if it wasn't for Kevin Rogers' persistence as an avid disc golfer himself. And interestingly enough, many of the brands that have turned their attention towards disc golf, like Adidas in the past and Bushnell more recently, all shared this one similarity with Grip 6. An individual who worked at the company was an avid disc golfer and advocate for the sport. So I had to ask, is an advocate in-house the secret sauce for future sponsorships in disc golf, or is it not that crucial?
So that's a great question. I think the best way to explain that, I probably have two answers for you. Very specific to Grip 6. I can't answer for other companies, but I think having someone on the inside is, in my opinion, kind of crucial. It's a double-edged sword for obvious reasons. Having someone there, in my opinion, keeps the connection from the brand to the sport a little bit more pure, a little more honest. I can't speak with authority, but you know, I think it sounds like you're fairly well-read too, and I try to dig into the stuff, but I think both Vibram and Keen may have had similar attributes, and I think that individual either moved on and the relationship, I don't want to use the word sour, but it diminished because that liaison was no longer there advocating. That may or may not be true. Again, I can't speak to that, but I've heard rumors that that's the double-edged part of the sword, is if that person ever goes away, then the connection is potentially lost. But what I will tell you from our side is, not only do we think it's kind of a necessity, we have used it as a pattern for additional marketing opportunities in the company. Case in point, we're actually pretty involved right now with skateboarding.
The Nine Club.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm familiar. So, yeah.
Yep. That was born 100% of having an employee who's ridiculously into skateboarding.
Wow.
And he came to us and said, hey, I think I have a way to get into this. And we let him run with it. And he's done a phenomenal job. Actually, it's the same marketing guy, Neil. So nice. He's done a great job. He's kind of opened up some doors and broadened some horizons. And we've started looking at that as kind of a blueprint, if you will. Yeah. If we're going to do this, then we need to have people on staff that can talk the talk and walk the walk and actually, you know, direct the company's involvement in that particular sport or marketing play.
That's super interesting, because I was going to go there with the Nine Club. I also saw chess, and, you know, seeing kind of where you all went, I was curious what the interest was in those niches. And that's really interesting to hear that it's really specific to a liaison within the company and really keeping it authentic.
Yeah. I think for us, especially, if we were just about making money, you know, I don't want to put ourselves on any kind of a pedestal. You have to make money. If you don't make money, then, you know, you don't get to
it's
have
not sustainable.
Exactly. You don't have other options. But if we do have a choice in how we make money, then I think having something that you're passionate about, whether it's me or one of the other three partners or one of our employees for that matter, if they can show up every day at work and it's like a passion project for them, I think it's so much more fun to come in and to apply yourself. That the energy we find goes up, you know, I don't want to use some anecdotal, you know, like tenfold, you know, I don't know that that's true, but you know, we do seem to get a lot more out of those people when they feel a vested interest in what they're doing.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, you know, we're going to assign you to do this particular thing that you have no interest in whatsoever. I think nobody wants to do that job. So it is random. I often worry, there's no doubt about it, that people sometimes look at us and go, okay, you went from belts to socks. I mean, where the hell is that connection? Chess was a weird one for sure, but same thing. We have chess players on board, and there's other things which I can talk about. I got permission to talk about. We have two or three other things in the hopper at the moment. We've been prototyping pickleball paddles for the last several months. Yeah. We actually have a pickleball court in our factory. And
no way.
It's like the most popular. We actually put in a disc golf course about a quarter of a mile away from us at the city park that's in our, you know, we worked with the city to put it in.
Very cool.
And the pickleball court is competing for lunch break time.
For attention.
Exactly. Which is good. Like our employees are having fun and doing that. And the engineers are having a blast.
So we talked about liaisons within the company for specific niches. And I just have to ask this because when I was doing my research, I found that Grip 6 belts have actually been worn by astronauts on three different space shuttles. Do you have a liaison who is an astronaut in the company?
No, there's two things I cannot explain. That one, which is we've actually reached out to them a couple of times to see if there's anything we can do to promote that.
So that wasn't organized in any way. They were just
no,
literal
we had
customers.
Nothing to do with it. Yeah, they chose it. We actually, this is embarrassing, but it's a good story. We didn't even know it happened until someone, like one of our super fans, sent us a picture, I think, of the astronaut group and
with
sent it to us,
on.
I think, on social media. And they're like, hey, I think these are yours. And we're like, oh, damn it. I think those are ours. So,
I mean, it really puts that aircraft grade aluminum to the test at that
point. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the other one is we've been featured in Hollywood loves our belts. I can't remember the guy's name. I'm not real into this stuff, but there was one that just got sent to us the other day, and this guy's a really bad guy. Like he kills a lot of people. So it's not something I'm like, oh, great.
In a movie, to be clear, we're talking about in a movie.
Oh,
he's
a
really bad
movies.
Guy.
Yes. Yeah. This isn't a real person, but you know, it's some kind of character in a movie who's quite nefarious. But anyways, we get our stuff is in movies or some kind of made for TV, blah, blah, blah. I would say like once every two or three months. And I'm not sure why But we have like a highlight reel stashed somewhere that we're really not, we can't use, you know, because it's all
of course
copyrighted, but it's pretty cool.
But the belt on a murderer definitely puts the old no PR is bad PR statement to the test.
Well, not only that, but like it's part of his outfit. It's not like he's not even wearing it as a belt.
It's a staple.
It's a work belt. So, you know, it's like a Easter egg if any of your listeners want to go find it, because I'm not sure it's out yet.
As an individual disc golfer, and as many individual disc golfers are listening to this and people are just curious, I think a lot of people can kind of sit back and think about, like, you know, the massive brands that are turning their eyes and attention towards disc golf, or that we want to turn their eyes and attention toward disc golf. And I think it can be paralyzing for an individual who might just kind of think, what can I do? You know, what can I do to actually make an impact there? What would you say to the individual disc golfer who's maybe thinking that type of thing when it comes to bringing brands into our sport?
I think that's an easy answer, actually. I'm a fly fisherman. My fly fishing tree, is, as far as people that I've taught, is, well, I don't keep track of it, but it's huge. Disc golf is no different. I mean, our little community that I live here in Salt Lake, you know, we've got kids that started, you know, when we first started, these kids were like 7, 8, 9 years old that were friends of my boys. And, you know, now they're adults. They're talking about, you know, banding together and seeing if they can get the Utah High School Sports Association to create like a legitimate disc golf league. You know, they already have one for Ultimate. So you don't need to make a stamp, you know, to leave your mark on the sport on a global or national or even statewide, I don't think. The effect that you can have is immediate, and it's like right in front of you.
Yeah.
So just pay attention. But more importantly, like, man, take someone disc golfing. That's like the easiest answer. Like, if you want to be effective. To be honest, my favorite part of the game is just going out and playing with, like, when I travel, I meet so many nice people on the course, and I try to keep my affiliation with disc golf in terms of Grip Six kind of on the DL until the very end, you know, which usually I'll give them a business card and, you know, tell them to send me an email and I'll send them a free belt or something. But I don't like using that as an icebreaker. I feel like it's disingenuous, but I've never had a bad experience, actually. So many times, like, sometimes there's like I don't know if this is sport wide, but around here anyway, and some other places I've played, there's kind of two divisions of disc golf, kind of the old guard and the new guard. You really can't tell the difference between them and a golfer. You know, they wear polo shirts and they're well dressed and pretty well behaved, and they're very serious about the game. And then you have these other guys that they got the boom box going, and they're, you know, just like a lot of golfers, actually, you know, they're probably 2 or 3 beers into the game, you know, and they have a tendency to look a little more rough around the edges, you know. Nothing wrong with that, actually, but they look a little more intimidating when you're out there with, you know, me and my wife and a couple of young kids. And when we first got started, we bumped into a couple of these guys. You know, my wife, she grabs my arm or something, like, she's real nervous about it. This guy approaching us, you know.
Yeah.
And then she's like, what's he going to do? And he comes up and he talks to my youngest boy, and he goes, hey, you're throwing the wrong disc. And he reaches into his bag, and I don't know why he's carrying this thing, but, you know, he pulls out 117 gram Valkyrie. And I'm like,
wow.
Who has 117 gram Valkyrie that's, you know, a grown man? And he's like, try this one. And my son gets up and throws it, and, you know, bombs it an extra 75 feet. And he's like, much better. And he's like, it's yours. He just gives it to him. And that's probably happened to us 2 or 3 times with our kids specifically.
The reality is he's probably carrying that 117 Valkyrie for that moment.
Yeah. When you go back to my earlier statement about the problem the sport has is the transition between I can throw it 50 feet to where, you know, I can actually unlock some of the kinetic chain. That's one of the elements. So if you want to be a power player in disc golf, just be that guy, you know, just go out there and be kind to people and give them a tool to unlock that next chapter, because that, especially with that particular son, he was the youngest of our family. So he felt like he was, you know, not able to compete with the rest of us, but, you know, now he's right up there with the rest of us. So
that's so cool.
And that was one of the key moments.
Yeah. What a great story. Wow. Kind of sounds like maybe a way to protect that part of disc golf while also moving forward is to keep that liaison thing we talked about earlier thing going. If there are advocates within the context of those companies for the sport that can really push for it. I mean, if you weren't at Grip Six, being very honest, they would have pulled disc golf before they got that data. So having those advocates can potentially help not only keep moving the sport forward with bringing brands in and bringing that money to the sport, but also to keep that passion and that authentic investment going. Would you agree with that?
I would, actually. I used to think that, and I've told a few people, actually, Sean from DGPT, him and I have had several conversations about this. He's a pretty smart cat. And I used to hold our marketing team pretty high. And not that I don't want to throw them under the bus at all. Actually, they're still, in my book, you know, some of the best. I think what sets us apart is that we do it internally. Most companies, like the vast majority, I would say 98% of companies do not do this stuff in-house. They hire firms who kind of understand that stuff. And we don't, we're manufacturers because we want to understand how things work and we want to make it ourselves. And that it goes right into marketing. We don't want to pay some other firm. No one's ever going to care about your product or your message more than you do. And so when I talk to Sean about those things, when I put ourselves on a pedestal, and I still do to this day, we understand it better than 99% of all of the companies. Most companies have to take some other firm's word for what's going on. But what I'll say there is that we're seeing, whether it's confirmation bias or whether it's actually happening, we're waiting on. We need to see a little more data, I should say. But we have a theory that, you know, COVID drove a lot of companies to get pretty guerrilla in their marketing. You know, people were shopping online, big companies that were resistant to kind of that model.
I mean, Jimmy Fallon was making videos out of his house with an iPhone, I believe. So it's, exactly. Yeah, everyone went guerrilla for sure.
Yep. I think there was this thought at that, you know, that kind of was running through everyone's head, like this is the new world. You know, this is what it looks like. But the truth of it is, this is what I think. This is the confirmation bias part. The truth of it is, unless those companies understand what's going on and they're not just believing in a marketing firm's message, what's happened is all those companies, just the same way I described, that's potentially a risk with disc golf, is that particular guerrilla, it's no longer guerrilla when everyone's doing it. You know, guerrilla is generally what everyone else isn't doing. So those big companies have their tolerance for that kind of stuff, because they're, for every one big play, in other words, for every, Marriott Open that's going to be on ESPN for 4 days, you've got to do 100 niche sports to make up in the aggregate the amount of exposure that you would get there. So that's a lot of effort. And the confirmation bias that I think right now, but I think it is going to happen, is some of these big players are probably going to step back a little bit from some of these niche, some of these guerrilla things that they experimented with during COVID. Mm-hmm. It's going to open those doors back up a little bit, but naturally we're going to see a drop off a little bit in participation for a little while. And that's going to be hopefully not too discouraging for people. I think that's okay. I think it's probably in the truth of it, it'll be healthy as long as everyone can survive that drop. I think in the end, if disc golf lands on its feet, which it will, and kind of maintains that foundation, I think it'll push forward and it'll attract, like you said, with those liaisons, it'll attract the types of companies that are there for the right reasons. Not just people who are out there trying to fill a quota of niche events in order to make up for races or events that are no longer or weren't happening during COVID. I think that's a critical element. I wish that was a metric that we could actually hold people to, where it's like, you know, are you guys in this because you want to be in this, or are you in this, yeah, just because, you know, the money or whatever.
So on that note, what excites you about the future of disc golf?
Right now, that's a pretty easy answer. As a kid, I was a skater. I like to tease my kids all the time that, you know, we used to wear these t-shirts, as I don't know how old people are listening to this thing, that said skateboarding is not a crime. You don't see those anymore because no one thinks it is.
Yeah.
You know, now like municipalities are building skate parks everywhere you look, right?
Yeah.
But when I was a kid, I was getting chased by cops off of parking lots because we were scratching, you know, whatever. And that's what I'm most excited for about disc golf, is in the last 5 years, we've seen a huge change in the way disc golf is perceived by local governments, county, state, federal, the amount of willingness and participation that they have to let the sport grow. I think there was a lot of resistance. Where it was coming from, I can't particularly say. But one of the biggest things that disc golf has above almost all other sports like it, I'll say that, because basketball, you know, if you look at basketball, if you don't have a hoop in your front yard, it's not a big deal. Every local park has a basketball hoop. Pickleball, similar transition in the last little while. There's, I don't know how many abandoned tennis courts there are in the state of Utah, but it's it's a ridiculous figure, but as they go through and resurface them and turn them into pickleball courts, they're like reservation room only, you know?
Yeah.
We're seeing that same transition with disc golf here locally, and I think countrywide, where all of a sudden people are looking at it and going, this is a viable sport. This is a great mixed use in certain cases, not, you know, not always mixed use. If you get into the higher level courses, I don't think it's a great idea to use mixed use stuff, but like we're seeing a real shift toward the acceptance of disc golf in this country as a utilization tool. State parks, I know Utah's, a bunch of our state parks have been putting them in recently. But it, to me, that's the turn that will keep the momentum in terms of the next generation and the next generation playing the game. I think it'll be on the backs of the sport to make sure we retain those people, or else, you know, they'll be resurfacing disc golf courses and turning them into something else, just like tennis.
It sounds like we might see a new Grip 6 buckle that says disc golf is not a crime. Is that on the horizon?
So, you know what? Should we?
That's Kevin Rogers, one of the partners at Grip 6. As of this recording, they continue to redefine how products can be made in the USA and are working on some products that could continue their trend of innovation. One in particular, and I'm not trying to overstate this, could literally change the future of disc golf. Since Grip 6's vision is to create high-quality products, currently that's belts, wallets, and socks, I wanted to ask you what's next. Earlier, you mentioned pickleball as a nice little sneak peek, but you said we have a few things, but you only mentioned pickleball.
Well, not quite 2 years ago, we started developing. We have a lot of, being engineers, we're fairly astute at this stuff, kind of the ISO, ASTM testing methodology. And we started developing a throwing mechanism, that like a mechanical throwing mechanism.
Ooh.
That right now we could easily submit to the Guinness Book of World Records and I think beat the current record by a factor of 3.
Wow.
But we're just not really concerned about that at the moment. We would like to take a little bit of the mystique out of the game. For example, like...
you're talking flight numbers, you're talking speed rating.
Exactly. We have that machine. It's sort of taken, we had that warehouse that we're currently in while it was being remodeled. It was a big empty 60,000 square foot warehouse and it became a disc golf chucking facility during that period. So we sort of developed that and we're pretty sure at this moment, it's all proprietary, of course, you know, several patents pending, but
awesome.
You know, we can alternate all sorts of things and we can actually with a relatively high degree of confidence tell you what a disc will actually do if released exactly into the same conditions as every other disc that claims the same things. If you ever study any kind of like medieval mechanics, you know, some of the most elegant, like a trebuchet, you know,
yeah,
it's such a slow moving animal, but it's able to throw, you know, like a 50 pound object, you know, 300 yards. It's not the getting the object up to speed that's the challenge, it's slowing it back down.
Wow.
And I'm not talking about the projectile, I'm talking about the machine. And so in the early days when we were trying to figure this out, discs have to go, when you really think about what the human body is able to do in the course of about 10 feet, it's pretty impressive. And so for a machine to be able to do that and then slow itself back down in the same amount of space, is pretty, pretty tough. I remember walking out in this warehouse, trying to find parts of the machine, that we had, unwillingly, unknowingly launched because we have 3D printers working overnight, trying to make new things to get it to work until we finally, we think, stumbled upon a fairly genius solution.
Incredible.
Yeah, we need a good name for it too. So maybe you could ask your listeners to name it for us.
I have an idea actually right off the bat for you. It could be, since you already did this with the buckle, it could be the official disc robot of disc golf. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Patent Pending is presented by Jomez Pro and is made possible by the Jomez Pro Patreon community. You can subscribe and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to follow us on Instagram, we are at Patent Pending Show. And if you want to contact the team, our email address is patentpendingshow@jomezpro.com. This episode was produced by Andy Padula with music composed by Starframe. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and you've been listening to Patent Pending.